So I'd like to talk with you today about something that seems so urgent that it's a bit of a detour from speaking directly about Afghanistan. It's quite possible that in the near future, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia will come to Boston and pay a visit to MIT. I hope that some of the scientists who are peacemakers who were invoked in that beautiful remembrance of Allen will be on hand to greet the prince. And I think it's extremely urgent to think about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman right now, because he's somebody who has said in May 2nd, actually, of 2017, that the war that the Saudi-led coalition, joined and supported by the United States, is waging against the poorest country in the Arab Peninsula, the country of Yemen, is a war which, if prolonged, will be in the favor of Saudi Arabia. He told his country in a nationalized televised speech, a prolonged war is in our favor. He said, time is on our side. And so it's so urgent to make sure that anyone who receives Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman recognizes and says to him, time is not on the side of the 8 million people facing starvation in Yemen, of the 1 million people identified to suffer from cholera, of the hundreds and thousands of children displaced and thirsting without access to clean water, of the people who have been disappeared into a clandestine network of 18 secret prisons. And it's so important to focus on Guantanamo here, because doesn't Guantanamo green light the possibility of clandestine prisons elsewhere? And in these terrible prisons, they must be enormously dreaded places. It's reported that the torture is so extreme that they actually truss bodies to a rotating spit, and the prisoners fear being roasted. 18 of those kinds of prisons are being operated by the United Arab Emirates. It's been written up in Human Rights Watch, in Amnesty International. And the United States is in close, close support to the United Arab Emirates and to the Saudis. It's a Saudi-led coalition that includes Sudan. And what is Sudan doing in Yemen? Well, the Sudanese government is sending over, as mercenaries in a sense, the greatly feared Janjaweed fighters. And they're fighting their way up the coastline. And so if I could just add something about the United States' role. Under President Obama, after the Saudis joined a very terrible civil war, March 15th of 2015, the Obama administration said, yes, we'll sell you weapons. Well, Boeing and Raytheon, they love that because the Saudis pay cash up front. So the United States began selling them cluster bombs and laser-guided missiles and a Patriot missile system and what are called littoral combat Navy ships. They're called littoral because they go along the coastline, like sidle out. So that's how the Saudis have been able to blockade the major ports of Yemen. And those of you who were so kind, your hearts were touched to the deep heart's core when you cared about children in Iraq. Hundreds of thousands and then millions of children in Iraq who suffered to death because of the United States economic sanctions against Iraq. Well, it's being repeated now. And in this case, the Saudis have blocked off the major vital port. There was news of the blockade being lifted, but it's not true. The blockade is still on. Ships are still being turned back. Desperately needed goods, including vaccines that could enable people to survive cholera, are being turned away. The United Nations people are still sounding the alarm and saying that there could be as many as 20 million people that could die in Yemen. Well, at one point, the Saudis bombed a funeral. And this was in October of 2016. 149 people had turned out for the funeral of a very important governor in the Sana'a area of Yemen. And the drone surveillance, thank you for the mention about drones, it's very capable of identifying who is going in and who is going out. The surveillance must have been adequate to recognize many, many, many civilians at this funeral. Nevertheless, the funeral was bombed and what was called a double tap was carried out. That means that after the rescue workers arrive to help those who've survived get some kind of medical treatment, that was the second hit. And when the Obama administration heard about that, they said, well, we won't sell you any more weapons. And I think it's worth mentioning that on October 2nd, 2015, the United States, in Afghanistan, bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital. October 27th, the Saudis bombed another Doctors Without Borders hospital. I think the saddest tweet I've ever read was posted by Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. It said, has bombing hospitals become the new norm? But you see, when Ban Ki-moon, then Secretary General of the United Nations, said to the Saudi king, you can't be bombing hospitals, the Brigadier General replied, his name is Brigadier General Azeri, Saudi general, he said, well, we'll ask our American colleagues for better advice about targeting. I mean, that's very cheeky, isn't it? Because, of course, the United States had just done the same thing. And that's what I mean about green lighting. And that is also one of the ways that the United States is responsible because of the appalling example that we've set. And so, at this point, President Trump has said, well, I'll sell you weapons. And he went over and danced with princes. And the green light is on again now for weapons to be sold. And there's great rejoicing, really, among some of the major military contractors. And if the crown prince comes here, he apparently wants to put Saudi Arabia sort of in the limelight as being open for business. He'd like people to take their huge oil company and make it a public offering. And so he wants to go to New York and visit the stock exchange. And he will also go to Houston and San Francisco and Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. Well, he was supposed to go to the U.K. Right about this time. But some very energetic young Quakers organized, and the king's advisor said, you know, maybe you better not make that visit right about now. We need to, you know, fine-tune a few things. And so it looks like he won't go to the UK until the 7th of March, and then possibly after that he would come to Boston. So I greatly hope that people here would be able to rally people to come together, and maybe particularly at MIT. Why is Yemen so mired in civil war? Why has this happened? I'm so glad to reunite with Sarah Fisher. And maybe one way I could begin is by saying that Sarah and I worked with a young woman also living and working at Voices, Sabia. And Meta Sabia Rigby was born in Ethiopia. And at one point, I don't know why anybody ever puts up with me at Voices, I always think I'm right. And at one point, we were trying to figure out, well, where are all the refugees actually going? Because we'd heard that 85% of the people seeking refuge were going to countries other than Europe or the United States. And so Sabia was looking and she said, well, you know, this says that Yemen is one of the major countries taking in refugees. And I said, oh, Sabia, that's got to be wrong. Well, that was right. In the year when the United States took in 80,000 refugees, 2016, Yemen, little tiny impoverished Yemen, struggling with disease and war, took in 117,000 refugees. There are already 225,000 Somali people living in Yemen. So I think this begins to suggest the wider picture of desperation. In the Arab Spring, young Yemeni people recognized the grievances that they faced. And as they did in Bahrain, these young people went to public squares. They were so brave. They were so energetic. They were so hopeful. And they changed this town square in the capital city of Sana'a to a new name. They called it Change Square. and they knew what was happening in Tunisia and in Egypt, and their hopes were so high. And, you know, Jean Sharp was mentioned. It's almost as though they were using the table of contents of Jean Sharp's book for their sort of list of methods from which to draw. And so these young people were trying to make it clear that while there was an elitism under 33 years of dictatorship under Ali Abdullah Saleh, the country's resources had been corralled and were being shared by cronies of Saleh. They weren't being shared equitably, and major problems were being ignored. And now it was so alarming because the water table has gone down so low, and now it's even lower. And that meant that farmers couldn't grow their crops, pastoralists couldn't feed their flocks, and so people were crowding into the cities. The cities were overstressed. They didn't have the sewage, the sanitation, the health care, the infrastructure. And so the cities were becoming disastrous places, and there was very high unemployment for the students themselves. They wouldn't find work if they graduated from their universities. And so they were coming together to sound those grievances. They should have been listened to. They should have been heard. The United States could have said to people that were getting together in the Gulf Corporation Council, listen to those young ones, but they were sidelined. And even though they had, after they'd gathered, suffered the loss of 50 students when plainclothes men with rifles on rooftops shot into one of their demonstrations and killed 50 students, they maintained so much discipline, they organized a 200-kilometer walk from Taiz to Sana'a, and they convinced the ranchers, who usually never leave their house without their rifle, to put down their guns and walk with them. Peasants, workers, ranchers, farmers, students, artisans, they all walked together. At one point, a large number of their colleagues were in prison, and that had to be very frightening for all of them. But again, they maintained incredible discipline, and they organized a lengthy fast outside the prison. These were people to be celebrated, not sidelined and ignored. And we might ask ourselves, well, what happened to them? But of course, when you think about networks of clandestine prisons that grotesquely torture people, I know I have no right to be asking, well, why don't they speak up? And so where are the voices that will speak up? There are Yemeni children who have committed no crime. There are still people coming to Yemen smuggled over on makeshift boats coming from Africa. So I'm just going to depart for a moment and tell you that about this time last year, the Sisters of St. Bridget of Kildare, Ireland, invited me to go to Ireland. And it was a bit of an anniversary of a Plowshares action connected to the 2003 Shock and Awe bombing, and the activists had all been acquitted, and I was their main defense witness. I thought I was mainly their albatross, but by a miracle almost, an Irish jury acquitted them after they'd done $2.5 million worth of damage to a United States Navy warplane parked on the tarmac in Shannon Airport. So anyway, I was happy to get together with people, and the sisters said, "Bakathi, could you meet us in a field?" I said, "Certainly, sister." And so there we all were. Our wool socks are soaking wet. We're standing out in a field. And we're right next door to a place called the Dunshlaugen Workhouse. And I'm with young high school boys, and they're all kind of snickering and wondering, what are we doing out here? And then along came a professor, a historian, and he began to tell about the workhouse having been the most dreaded spot in the middle of the Victorian era, around 1845 to 65. If any Irish person ended up in the workhouse, that meant they could no longer feed their family, feed themselves. And behind the workhouse, Danny then showed us a mass grave, and unidentified bodies had been poured into the grave, and then the sand and the dirt poured over them. 1.5 million people fled Ireland during what they called an Gorta Mór, the Great Hunger. 1 million died of starvation. And so the young boys weren't snickering anymore as Danny read off the names of the people in that area who were believed to have died in the workhouse. Well, I, growing up as a child of a mother who had grown up in Ireland and narrowly missed a workhouse, really, I knew about that famine, but do you know, I'm 65 years old, and it was only because of doing a little bit further research recently that I finally learned that during that same time period, give or take some years, in northern China, in India, and in Brazil, 20 to 50 million people starved to death. Imagine the suffering, the bereavement, the trauma. It never makes it into our history books. And I guess that's part of my own U.S. exceptionalism, that somehow those lives didn't matter. We never knew. But we must know. And it turns out that similar to the situation in Ireland, colonial authorities could have gotten food. There were transportation networks. The food could have gotten to many of the communities where people were starving. But instead, it was exported to people who were relatively opulent. And so I think about that Dunschlaugen workhouse and the graveyard today. And I think about the relative cloud of unknowing, in a sense, that surrounds what's happening in the Horn of Africa and Yemen right now. And there's something that's called the Sima, the Great Leveler. And it's the third year of drought going across Africa. And the elderly men with the hennaed beards, they say, we've never in our lifetimes experienced something like this, 3 years in a row of drought. And what causes that drought? In part, is caused by northern industrialist greenhouse gases. And so what it means is that people can't survive where they are. They're eating the trees, so they pack up what they can, and they go. And they used to go to Libya and try to go through Libya and maybe get to Morocco and maybe get beyond. But that's out now, so people don't always know what they're getting themselves into, and they'll go over to Yemen. Well, that's a very bad deal, because these smugglers are heartless. The smugglers will pack people into a boat, and sometimes the boat capsizes, and recently a boat capsized because the smugglers were trying to extort more money from these beleaguered passengers, and there was a panic, and 30 people, including women and children, drowned when that boat capsized. And so when people get over to Yemen, sometimes they're taken hostage, and they're roughed up, maybe even tortured, and then people back in their homes are told, send money. You know, they're forced to yield a phone number or a way to contact someone who might send money, and that's the way that the smugglers can make a little more. But when I think about the heartlessness of those people that are involved in human trafficking, I think I better also recognize that there's an equivalent heartlessness. Heartlessness. When United States congressional delegations, like the one recently led by Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, go over to dance with the princes and make deals and send more weapons, because these weapon systems are used to attack civilians, to destroy infrastructure, to destroy food production. They're used to hit hospitals, buses, roadways. They're used to make it impossible for people to survive what is already a terrible, terrible situation. Now, my young friends in Afghanistan, when I first told them, you know, Voices is going to start to focus a bit more on Yemen, I could tell there was a bit of uneasiness. You know, they would have had a right to say, well, what about us? They would have had a right to say to me, did you think we don't know something about hunger and thirst and displacement and bereavement and being bombed? About a week later, they got in touch with me, and they said, Kathy, you probably know that at the end of Ramadan, every year, it is our tradition to take up a collection. And this year, we want you to somehow get whatever we collect to people in Yemen. And they collected $45.78. And I haven't been able to get into Yemen yet to deliver it. And even the Yemeni people whom I've asked, could you take it, they can't get in. There's only one flight per day that is a UN flight going into Sana'a, the capital, where so many people are dependent to get whatever might come in terms of goods. And the Saudis vet that flight every single day. And if anybody is on the flight who doesn't work for the United Nations or hasn't been with a registered group for many years, they won't let the flight go through. They say, you send that flight and we won't give you fuel and you won't be able to get the flight back the next day. So I haven't been able to follow through on that, but I guess maybe I could close by saying that my young friends are very, in Afghanistan, are very involved in surveillance. Every day they look up at the skies and they see four tethered blimps spying on their city of Kabul. And there are drones constantly crisscrossing the skies, collecting miles and miles and miles of footage. And people get paid enormous sums of money to study that footage and establish patterns of life in Afghanistan. Well, my young friends go up the mountainside, and sometimes they take me with them, and they have to hold on tight because I don't do so well trying to get up that mountainside. But I watch them then take out their pads, and they write down in the pad the answers to questions, and they're very difficult questions. How many times a week does your family eat beans? Does your family have access to any clean water? Who earns an income in your family? And how old is that person? How do you pay rent? And women weep, and they say, we move from place to place. We move higher up the mountain where there's no water, and we don't have a way to pay the rent, and we don't want to send our children out to work. We want our children to go to school, but the children are the only ones who can go to the marketplace and maybe pick up some scraps of potatoes or turnips, and maybe they can earn a little bit of money by selling tissues or by washing cars or polishing shoes. And so my young friends take all that information, and then they sit down, and they're teenagers. They should be having a lot more fun in their life, really, than they have. They sit down and sort through their surveys after they've done their surveillance, and they decide who will be the women this year that will make the heavy blankets. They're called the duvets. And then the young ones have got it organized so well to make sure those duvets get distributed. And Pat Ferrone has been helping for years with this, and many of you. They get distributed free of charge in the refugee camps, which are always becoming more and more overcrowded. And then they've set up a school. And, it's kind of, it's like an old car. It doesn't start. But they got it right now. And they figured out that one thing that would really retain kids coming to this place where they can get tutoring in order to go to the government school would be to assure the moms that every month the mothers will get a ration of rice and cooking oil, sometimes beans. And then the kids, it's so wonderful to see them. They're just gleaming when they get the first clean new shirt they've ever had. So they get one change of clothes to wear to school and a backpack. And so that has worked quite well, and it's the product of a good kind of surveillance. The United States could be paying reparations for the suffering, the terrible suffering that our wars have caused. We could and we should. I'm going to confess to you that I don't know the language anymore very well for speaking to our new generations of college-educated youth. I was on a Skype call, and I couldn't make eye contact, and I was frustrated, and because I want to communicate. And the question was, well, when you used to go over to Iraq or when you go to Afghanistan, aren't you exercising your white privilege? And isn't that cultural appropriation? You're appropriating their suffering as though it's your own. And I need to find the way, and maybe it's not up to me really to try to find this way, but to say, in our world today, everybody is, in a sense, linked and shackled, if you will. We're imprisoned by the new religion. I used to say the national religion in the United States was shopping. But I don't say that anymore. Now I believe the national religion is militarism. Militarization is the consequence. And it's happening so much. I mean, they've corralled so much of our budget. They are what Dr. Martin Luther King called the demonic suction cup. And they got more than they even asked for. It's just gravy for the Pentagon. And they make weapons, and they sell weapons, and they can't get that weapon train going unless there are wars. So they make wars, and they market wars, and they give people rationales. It doesn't even matter. People barely need them anymore. We're so used to being a permanent warfare state. And so I think we're all kind of shackled to that. And it does affect life here, not anywhere near to the extent that it affects people in Yemen and in Somalia, Nigeria and Kenya and Afghanistan and Iraq. But we are bearing, I believe, the moral consequences of our warlordism as well. And so it's my hope that our younger friends will be able to find the language that is encompassing, that's adequate to the task, to the very terrible problems we face. And that they'll insist, those that are going to schools, that their professors help them in that and not, you know, kind of rerun language that may not be up to the task. And I have to say, I'm not quite sure I have it. I have the stories, and I know that I can't turn away from a mother sitting cross-legged with her infant in her arms when that child doesn't have food and doesn't have some kind of water that's clean, and say, well, I can't really try to represent what you're saying to me because I don't have the agency to do it. So we face a new time. It's full of opportunities, full of, I think, as Dr. Sharp would have bequeathed to us, many, many, many methods. But it certainly demands of us to try to hear, to listen really, really carefully to what's being bequeathed to us by the people who can't escape our wars. I was in prison in 2015. I think I came here after that. I probably had told you about getting a chance to be with the gospel choir, and that was a wonderful thing for me. I'm going to just close with a few lines that women taught me. I've spoken of very, very heavy realities, but I think we can also imagine, we have to imagine, a time when there's a sort of a opening in the storm, a time when the winds aren't buffeting the world, and a time when we might actually be able to see further. So Dan Bergen liked to say, he rebuked the wind and there came a great calm. A calm always follows, or almost always, a question and then an answer, a storm and then a miracle. Sometimes, but not always. It's over now, it's over now. I think the worst is over, the storm is over now. Do you want to sing that? It's over now, it's over now. I think the worst is over, the storm is over now. I would hear a woman crooning that song to another woman who would be in despair and in tears. She would have just finished a call with her baby, with her child, and she wasn't going to get out for 5 more years. And how could she go on? How could she go on the next day? And the women would sing that to one another, shackled and confined and hopeless as they were. So I know I don't dare not feel hope, not imagine a time when our wars are over, and not work every single day, assured that there's nothing more important than abolishing war.